to do is I want to continue on in Romans. And the reason the gospel is so important is because what is revealed from heaven in verse 18?
The wrath of God.
Okay, the wrath of God. And who is it revealed against? Okay, all unrighteousness and all ungodliness. So, and as the book will now proceed, there's going to be three different sections. In the first section, he's going to talk about the apostasy. In the second section, he's going to talk about those people in the world today who think they're morally upright and that they're good enough for God because they're a little better than everyone else. And then he will conclude with which group? The Jews. And he will show, by the time we get to chapter 3, verse 23, that who has sinned?
All
have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So there's no possible way for anyone to be saved without the gospel. That's really the point of the first three chapters, is to show that no one will be able to stand before God on the judgment day and convince God that he can be saved without the blood of Christ. And the only way we can have access to the blood of Christ is through the gospel. So this particular section is laid out to explain to us how the sins of Adam were passed down from generation to generation. You remember chapter 5, verse 12, he's going to say that sin or death passed all men because what? Because all men sinned. So how did all men sin? How did sin pass down through the generations? And so he's going to be dealing with this, and he's going to be dealing with something that a lot of people question, and that is, how can God hold people responsible if they never get taught anything? And that's where he's going to be dealing with in this particular section, is here's how it happened and here's how God sees it. So God's wrath is revealed. So this is the present set of circumstances, and this is why the gospel needs to be preached to the entire creation. So God's wrath, what exactly is God's wrath? Okay, judgment. Well, it's judgment, but how's God feeling before that judgment?
Angry.
See, wrath is not a very nice word. And when we see God's wrath poured out, for example, on the ancient world, how did God manifest his wrath? With a flood. How did he manifest his wrath to Sodom and Gomorrah? With the fire and the brimstone. How did he do it with Israel before the Babylonian captivity? That was a brutal. I mean, if you read what had happened there, I mean, when God describes it in Deuteronomy about eating your own placenta, about being ripped open, about starving and killing other people and eating them, does that sound pretty brutal? And you say to yourself, how could God do that? Well, God didn't do that. What God did is God took everything away from them, and because they were so reprobate, what did they do? That's what they did. But God put them in a position where they were going to starve to death. And when people are going to starve to death, what do they start thinking about? Food. Now, most of us here, well, I wouldn't say most of us, all of us here, would you think about eating somebody else? See, it's just not our conditioning. But if you're wicked enough and selfish enough, you don't care about things like that. So wrath describes God, and I guess the worst position or the worst description of God's wrath may be the one where Jesus says there'll be weeping, gnashing of teeth, and complete despair and agony. And that's what sin is going to bring. And God really doesn't have a choice because of his character, right? In other words, must everyone receive what they've done? Must everyone receive what they've deserved?
So,
yeah, the justice of God. So as we move into this section now, we're going to see that God has revealed to man, and I've got a section in here on how God revealed it, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. So let's let's drop down to the top of page 27 or 28, where we talk about the wrath of God being revealed against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men. Now, what does ungodliness mean? Well, let's go one step closer. What does godliness mean? What is it to be a godly person? Excuse me?
Godlike.
Okay, godlike, meaning what? Can't be like God unless what?
Doing good.
Well, you're thinking about God, and you're thinking about wanting to be like Him. You wanting to you want Him. You respect Him. You love Him. You have reverence, and you want Him to be pleased with you. So, what's ungodliness?
The opposite end.
Yeah, you just don't care. You don't care what God thinks. You don't care how God looks at you. Matter of fact, it goes a step further. You don't like God. You hate God. We have people who hate God today. Yeah. And there's a verse we'll see in a little bit where it says haters of God. People that hate God. They just hate the concept of a being who would have that kind of control over them. And so the ungodly are those who have no care or concern toward God. What about the unrighteous? Righteousness is a little broader because godliness is directed totally toward God. What about righteousness?
I just don't do what God asks.
Well, toward God, but what other group of people can we bring in to be righteous? Our fellow man, right? In other words, you look at the Ten Commandments, if you want to be righteous, the first four have to do with God. The last five, or last six, excuse me, have to do with? With our fellow man. So unrighteousness carries our attitude toward our fellow man and toward God. And so when you think about agape love, when we look at God, will create godliness. And agape love, when we look at our fellow man, will create righteousness. Because righteousness means I want to be fair, I want to treat people fairly, I don't want to use people, I don't want to take away from people that which is theirs, I don't want to covet anything that is theirs, I want them to enjoy their life like I enjoy my life, and I don't want to intervene in any way that would damage that. That's what agape love is. That's also righteousness, right? I want to be fair to people. You know, if somebody gives me too much money when I go into the grocery store, yes, it's an unrighteous thing for me to take the money, but don't you feel sorry for the person? What's going to happen later if you take that money? They're going to answer for it, and I don't know that they do it anymore, but it used to be. You had to make that up. So if somebody gives you a change for a 20 when you gave them a 10, just keep in mind that not only are you stealing, but also you're not showing agape love. You're not manifesting the proper attitude. And I think the deeper and better way to get rid of these unrighteous acts is to develop that do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Then you can't do those kind of things, right?
In your title, it says the apostasy of man, apostasy related, you know, to the word apostate. You could be one that's a Christian and you fall away and apostate your... being even worse than someone that's never, you know, heard the gospel.
Right.
You heard the gospel, say, I don't need it anymore. You go backwards. And, like Lot's wife, you turn around and go backwards.
Right.
That's,
yeah.
That's even a worse condition.
And Paul spends a lot of time on that in this book, and the Hebrew writer does. So, yeah, that's a very serious issue. All right. They hinder the truth in unrighteousness. You remember what Jesus said to the Pharisees? Not only will you not enter, but those who are trying to enter, you hinder. You try to keep them from coming in. So Satan does this, and men also do this. They sit down and they try to figure out, how can we get people to quit obeying the gospel? How can we get people to quit obeying the gospel or being faithful to the gospel? Do you get a sense maybe Hollywood's trying to do that right now? Or had, not just right now, but for the last 50 years that they've been trying to hinder the gospel, the schools are trying to hinder the gospel by what they're teaching? You get that sense? It isn't just people falling away because of the culture. It's people falling away because other people are trying to undermine their faith. I've read that some of these college professors, they just enjoy taunting Christians and throwing out arguments to Christians that they've never heard before in the hopes of destroying their faith. And from what I've read, they're pretty effective at it. There's a lot of people who go to higher learning who end up losing their faith because it just wasn't grounded into them well enough. Virgil?
Yeah. In our society, especially in our school system, the lower grades, I don't know that it's lawfully forbidden, but it's really looked down on when a teacher might have something to say that is complimentary of God or the Bible or things of that nature. And they have to quit teaching that.
Right.
And I, like I say, I don't know whether or not that's an unlawful thing. A lot of it is not unlawful. Is all it is that the peer pressure causes it to happen.
Right. Well, but today we have atheists who are saying a teacher can't even have a Bible on their desk. We don't even want a Bible to even be in the consciousness of people that they exist. And what are they trying to do with all these crosses that have been developed? They want to get rid of them. Why? What difference does it make? They're already there. Why would they want to get rid of them? Yeah. Wanting to hinder the truth. They're wanting to get people. They're wanting to completely strip everything out of the world so that people won't have an opportunity to hear the gospel. Now, how's God feel about that? Can you see why he'd be angry with that? I think that evolution, you know, we like to think, well, evolution is just a scientific theory, but when you really break it down, does it have any sense to it at all? So what's the motivation behind it? Well, it's the best alternative. If you don't have an alternative to Christianity, then what have you got? Nothing. How can you hinder the truth if you don't have something to hinder it with? So what we have in the world today is we have a conflicting doctrine. Now, did they have that in the first century too? Yeah. What were the Greeks? What were the Greeks scoffing about? The foolishness of the gospel. But then you look at what they believe. You know, the pantheistic teachings of Greek religion, and so. Yeah. Thanks, George. You want a book? Is that what you're coming for? Thank you. Whoop. Okay, we're on page 29. Rob?
Yeah, if you don't want to be obedient, then what you start doing is you start discounting the Bible and its validity, inspiration from the scriptures, its authority, and then you start attacking, you know, even if there's a God and his creation, and so you just, and we see this all the time, if you listen and read some things, that people don't want to adhere to it, so as you're pointing out here, they're going to, they not only won't do it, but they'll actually go, they'll hinder it, they're going to stop the mouths of people. You can't say, you know, something that you believe, but they sure can. So it just doesn't make any sense to me. And so we're inundated with this, and with our access to information now is at the greatest heights it's ever been. The internet and social media, phones and all this kind of stuff. The devil's using those tools to try to put down in our own mind about things.
Right. Yeah, no, that's right. And God's wrath is created because of that. You know, and some of this is simply self-preservation. In John 3, when the light comes into the darkness, what has to happen? If the people want to stay in the darkness, what do they have to do?
Run from the light.
They've got to suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They've got to find a way. Like the Pharisees. He's performing miracles, yes, but by the power of the devil, by the power of Beelzebub. So what are they doing? They're hindering the truth and unrighteousness. They are twisting the truth just enough to create a situation. And God, how can God, I don't care, let's say that this occurs and now we're 50 generations in and the people who are still suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, but now, like in maybe in China or in some of these other cultures where before, as Rob just pointed out, before the internet and before all these things, maybe there are some people there. We talk about people in deep, dark Africa, or we talk about people who have never had the opportunity to hear the gospel, but they're suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, even though they're doing it in ignorance. Is God going to say, well, it's okay because now it's in ignorance? No, that's not going to, it's not going to happen that way. God is going to hold them accountable, and we're going to see why because God has given them no excuse. There's no excuse, no matter how far into it you are. George?
Well, as it says in Colossians, the gospel was preached throughout the whole world, and all of these situations that of unrighteousness are man's fault because they turn from God, because God, beginning with Adam and Eve, clear down to now, has given mankind the requirements and the consequences, and God doesn't force man to do right or to do wrong, either one. But man chooses to do wrong.
Right. Okay, so continuing in verse 19, which is at the top of page 29, we have a term, because. And the word because, as you can see, I've got the definition in here. It means on this account. It's actually a compound word, and it has a very logical, precise meaning. And as I say, God is laying out his case here. He is laying out his case. And again, we're going to see this on the judgment day. On the judgment day, when God is actually judging each individual, we're going to be seeing these same principles laid out again. He's just telling us now. Just like in chapter 2 when he says, are you treasuring up for yourselves wrath in the day of wrath and the righteous indignation of God? In other words, the opportunities to see the truth are here. And so basically the way this works is God has put into the heavens. You remember we talked about this a few months ago. Where did God put the evidence that he exists? Is it in the Bible? The evidence that he exists? No, there's no verses in the Old Testament or the New Testament that says, here's how you know God exists. What does he say, for example, in Psalms 19? What declares the glory of God? What declares his existence?
The heavens.
And the earth. The things that are made proclaim his everlasting power and divinity. Now, you can work as hard as you want. Can you suppress that? Can you suppress that truth?
No.
The complexity of the universe requires a creator. And in any logically thinking mind, that's a conclusion you're going to draw. I take out my cell phone. This cell phone is just the result of 1,000 lightning strikes. And what are you going to look at me and say?
You're wacko.
You're insane. So then we look at is the creation a little more complicated than this cell phone?
Yeah.
And we say, well, it was just a big explosion back somewhere back there. And this is, anyone with an ounce of sense will see what?
Organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can't be true. And that's what this verse is saying. What is known of God is manifested in them, for God manifested it in them. There's just no excuse. Now, granted, once you reason that there has to be a God, now there's a disconnect, but then we have God taking over, because what does God tell us in Isaiah and in Jeremiah? His eyelids are doing what? They're going to and fro, and what is he assessing? All the hearts of men. He knows what's in our hearts, and he knows, as Jesus told Paul in Corinth, I've got many people in this city. Paul didn't know it yet, but did Jesus know who they were? Jesus know who's going to obey the gospel? So when God sees this guy in China, or he sees this guy in Russia, or he sees this guy in Africa, and he sees he has a good and honest heart, is it very difficult for him to bring an Ethiopian eunuch along to teach him? No, providentially, that's what God can do. And so the process, of course, is in God's heart and in God's mind. But we see the initial portion of it here, and that is he's put within the heavens. It says their line has gone out into all the earth, and day unto day their speech is heard. I see a hand somewhere. Oh, Brian?
Yeah, even idolaters recognize there's a supreme being. They just go the wrong route, And so mankind in general, as is mentioned here and in other passages, just looking at the universe and the organization and how intricate our bodies are and all of that, it's led a lot of men over time to the conclusion there's a supreme being.
Right.
And so these idolaters, they've just chosen to, Genesis talks about men worshiping the stars. And they're trying to find an outlet. Well, I need to worship something. There's obviously a supreme being. And, it's their desire to learn the truth that separates them from an idolater.
Right. And, of course, God takes a lot of time in Isaiah to talk about that. They've got eyes, they've got mouths, but can they see? Can they've got legs, but who has to move them around? He said, you really think that that's what created the heavens and the earth? You really think that that has any power and control? And then God makes a conclusion. But it's funny because in America, can we see how foolish the creation myths of Babylon or Rome or Greece are? But can we see how foolish our creation myth is? As I've said so many times now, 1,000 years from now, when people look back on our creation myth, you think they're going to feel any differently than we do about Greece and Rome? How foolish it is? How completely inconsistent it is with the facts? So God has, and God will have a case, and this is Paul's point as we go through this particular section. Again, we're getting to the point of all sin and fall short of the glory of God. There's none righteous, no, not one. Everyone has to obey the gospel. That's just a given. There's no one out there who can go before God and skate through this. God is going to deal with it because God has manifested it to them. Okay, let's go ahead and verse 20. The invisible things of Him. Now, He will define what those are in a little bit. What are they? What are the invisible things from Him? His everlasting power. His everlasting power and His divinity. And these are clearly seen. It's the medium. Now, we've talked about this in the past. There's waves all around us. There's radio waves. There's television waves. There's all kinds of waves. And how do you know they're out there? Well, you get a medium. You turn on your TV and what happens? You get a picture. What does that mean? Well, I got an antenna on my roof, but if something wasn't coming to that antenna, what would happen?
Nothing.
I just have a blank screen. The fact that I have channels, and I can, I think, right now it's amazing to me, I think I have 50 channels that I get from this antenna on my roof, and it's amazing to me how each channel can pull out that signal. And so the television, to me, is an amazing example of how a medium can manifest things. How about the material creation? What does it do? Well, it manifests. I don't care what channel you put it on, you're seeing the everlasting power and divinity of God. You're seeing His creative genius. You're seeing His power. You look at the sun. You look at the universe, the complexity of the universe. The other day, I was looking at an MRI of my back, and he was just kind of going along, and I'm just thinking to myself, how can anybody look at something like that and say there's no God? Just this one little piece. And so every channel we turn to, you look at the human body, you look at the ocean, you look at the universe, you look at the stars, you look at the anatomy and physiology, what do you see? You see the everlasting power and divinity of God. And so the invisible things of Him, and it seems like from this that not only did God create the earth, heavens and the earth to be functional, but He also created it to be overwhelming. For example, why did God put all those stars out there? Think we needed all those stars? And you say, well, how do you know, Alan? Maybe the physics, you got to have all those stars for it to work together. Well, I really don't know. But I do know that when you get down, I watched a show a few weeks ago about what's down 10,000, well not 10,000, but 5,000 feet in the ocean. There's some critters down there that are absolutely amazing. And you think to yourself, I wonder why God put those down there. But no matter where we go, like David said, if I go to the highest heavens, if I go to the depths of the sea, what do I find?
You're there.
You're there. And you're there, and I can see you're there by what's there when I get there. And so there doesn't matter whether you live in Alaska or if you live on the Arctic or you live in the tropical deserts, what do you see there? Just amazing creations, amazing. How could that live in the sub-zero temperature? How can that live in the area where there's no water and no, and yet do they? See, God has the ability, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, to make a body suitable for the environment. Different body for fish, different body for birds, different body for reptiles, different body for amphibians. Since the creation of the world, the things that God has made are a medium, just like the television set. But most people turn on the TV, do they think about the waves and do they think about how amazing it is? No, they just use it. They just turn it on and use it. But what about when they look at the material creation, do they see God? And they don't see Him. But whose fault is that? I mean, familiarity breeds
contempt.
And of course, You know, these kids today, I look at a CD and I look at that thing and I think to myself, how in the world can a CD or a DVD or a Blu-ray, how can they put on there and something translated and put a picture on the screen? You ever think about that? How amazing that is for them to be able to do that? But most people, what do? They just stick it in the machine, watch a movie, and they never make the applications. And they go through life and they never look and they never make the applications. Shame on them. Let's see, I think there's two hands here. Virgil and then Rob.
A few years ago when I was up at a lake, we go up to Dumont Lake, and kind of a ramp at the dock, and I was just standing there, and a lady came up, and they had just finished a rainstorm, and there was a beautiful rainbow out there. And she commented on the rainbow, how beautiful that was, and I said, this is an opportunity that we have to recognize that God exists. I said, that rainbow is a message to us that the earth will never be destroyed by a flood again.
Right.
And you can read in the scriptures about that. And here it is. Today, we're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, I never thought about it that way. Turned around, walked off.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd get 2 bits worth in there.
You may have never thought about it again, right?
Yeah.
But we do. Hopefully, when you see that rainbow, you see it, and I've seen a double rainbow, I've seen a triple rainbow, and somehow those are more exciting. But what's the most exciting part of the rainbow?
God promised
it. It's a covenant. It's a covenant, and God says, when I see the rainbow, I'm going to remember my promise. What about us?
Yeah,
see, we need to remember it too. It's an opportunity to cement our faith. Rob?
It's our opportunity, but we're missing out as parents and grandparents. I think a verse in Deuteronomy about, you know, when we walk and talk about these things, we have them on our mind. We need to make sure our children, grandchildren, when they see these things, you explain these things to them that because of all the influence of other things, and tell them about the Creator and what He's done and what we see. We're really missing out on that if we don't do that. I mean, I was thinking on the way to services today how pretty the snow was on the mountains.
Right.
And if you drive around Colorado and you haven't looked at the mountains in a while, it just increases our faith. But as Virgil said, don't be afraid, don't be ashamed to say these to others. Now, some may not like it, but... you have to be careful, but you know what's wrong with saying, "Hey, God has given us these things and has blessed us with these things, and the nice warm day, and the snow and things." We live in a society now you can't hardly bring any of that up,
right?
And it's sad. It really is. Now in the workplace, we have to be careful because we have all this diversity stuff. Where I took a class, and the class, basically the outcome of that class was, you can believe anything you want, just don't say it. Well, okay, in the workplace, I'm just letting everybody know, be careful. But when you're out at that lake, and you can say something to somebody, that may be something that puts in their head that there's a God and that we're going to suffer the wrath of Him if we don't believe in what He says and be obedient,
right,
to His righteousness.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Faith comes by hearing the Word of God, but faith also comes by hearing the creation. He speaks to me. Remember that song? He speaks to me
everywhere.
I don't just have to see Him in the Bible. The moment you get up, you see the sunrise. Is God speaking to you?
Okay.
Have an opportunity to faith. You sit down to your meal. Is that meal kind of an explanation? Didn't Paul tell the Athenians he didn't leave himself without witness because He's given us all of these blessings and let's use them to draw us nearer to Him? We're going to be talking a little bit about that in our lesson this morning. George?
Unfortunately, we live in a society where so many of us are living in a big city like this that unless you take your children out to where they can see the sunrise or the sunset, in the middle of the community you live in, you may have a hard time ever even seeing one.
Right.
And so
that's true.
A lot of these things like that. Someone who lives in parts of New York City, if they were to come out here and see Colorado, they wouldn't even know what to think because they've never seen such things.
Yeah.
And they've never seen a sunrise and a sunset.
Right.
So So it makes it necessary for parents to read and study the Bible and actually get out with their children and show them some things.
Right.
Yeah, and that's one of the benefits of going to a third world country where they don't have technology and they don't have electricity, and you're closer to the land. And I noticed in Malawi, I watch the moon. I mean, I see all the phases of the moon. I never even look at the moon here. Anybody here? How can you look at the moon? But over there, that's part of it. And you see things there that you don't really pay attention to here. Jennifer and then Virgil.
One of the things that I noticed about the scriptures is that because the people were so connected to the land, they were raising animals, they were involved in agriculture and things like that primarily. They didn't have software developers and architects and things like that. Everybody was connected to things that were natural.
Right.
And God spoke to them through things that were natural. He said, I'm the vine and you are the branches, you know, and that sort of thing. And he said, you know, look to the ant. And all of these things were natural. When we have no connection to the natural world, it's like George was saying, when you grow up in a city where everything is tall buildings and you don't even see any trees, it's harder to understand the way that God speaks to us in the Bible using the examples that he
right.
does, because we're so disconnected from the natural world that
yeah.
he created.
That's a good point. Some kids have never seen a chicken or a cow, have they?
Except on their plate.
Yeah, on their plate. They buy it at the store. They don't have to go through the experience. I'll never forget the first time I watched a chicken running around with its head cut off. My mom used to use that expression all the time. I had no idea what it was. But I watched somebody cut the head off a chicken, and I'm going to eat that? But hang on a second, Ray. Virgil, did you have a comment?
No, I'll be just acknowledging what you said about looking at the moon.
Right.
That I do.
Oh, you do here?
Well, I got pictures of it.
Oh, okay.
No, I like that. You know.
Do you? Well, I do it now, but I never did. Ray?
When I was 10 years, 5 or 6 or 7, my cousin lived in California. I was like, he came to Colorado, went outside his bare feet. Mommy, what is that white stuff on the ground? It hurts so much on my feet. Because he'd never seen
it. Yeah. Yeah.
No idea what that stuff is.
Okay, so I guess when we add this all up, and we've just talked about a couple of anecdotal things, but there's so much in the scriptures and in the physical creation that when people stand before God and they say, I couldn't know, he's going to be able to rewind their life to a specific point and say, you see right here, remember when you made this application? All you'd have to have done is taken another step. And that's what God's going to be able to do with all of us. And so let's hit now on verse 21. Let's see, the bottom of page 32. And let's talk a little bit about when they knew God and when they didn't glorify him as God. Now, there's two main views here. One is that this is specifically dealing with the giving up of the Gentiles. And the other view is that this is something that happens generation after generation after generation, that he's not talking of it a specific event, but simply talking about how all cultures end here. Because can we apply this verse to America today? Can we see how America has gone from knowing God to not knowing God, and now we're giving over to homosexuality? I mean, can we see step by step how this happens?
Yep.
So this happens again and again. Matter of fact, I look at this section as first-generation apostates. There's lots of first-generation apostates as we go through the history of the Jews, and we see this. We do see it in Sodom and Gomorrah, but we also see it in the Judges. You remember when when the 10 tribes had to go up against Benjamin? Because what was Benjamin doing? Well, they just raped a Levite's concubine. But what did they really want? They wanted the Levite. So do we see how they went from knowing God to the same point? And we see it in Rehoboam's day, where the Sodomites come back into the land. So this is not just a single exclusive situation. And the other thing that makes it a little bit difficult is, did all the cultures do what Paul's saying here right after Noah? The only people we know did it are the Canaanites. Seven nations of Canaan, and And, of course, Egypt is also said, you shall not do according to the doings of the nation you've come out of. You shall not do according to the doings. And then he lists all the incestuous situations along with bestiality and homosexuality and adultery and a lot of other things. So these things did occur, and this very well could be describing the giving up of the Gentiles and the initiation of the Gentiles. And I'm certainly not going to say it doesn't. It probably does. I'd say the probability is that that's what he's talking about here. But the fact of the case is that even if that's true, is that the only time it happened? No, it happens again and again and again and again. People know God, they give him up. Virgil?
A couple of comments, and I agree with you. We see that happening to the church, too. Now, you have a faithful church that starts, comes into existence, and probably 50, 60, 70 years on downstream, you don't have that anymore.
Right.
It changes. With now, this is the way that I've always looked at this. With the Gentile, with the Gentile nations, there's very little that we really know about the Gentile nations. We know more about what we call the Jewish nation and trappings of how God set things up so that they, a known way of worshiping him. But for the Gentiles, there we do get a glimpse every once in a while, like Melchizedek. Somebody, somehow, Melchizedek learned, and he was acceptable by God as a priest. How did that happen? Somebody in that realm knew God. I would, for a moment, think and say that all people that we don't read about were reprobate. I don't believe that that's the case,
right.
but I have no evidence to take one or two or three or a nation and say they were okay.
Yeah.
The only ones that I can say with some semblance of accuracy would be the Jewish, and what turned out to be the Jewish nations, that they are more in line and they had a system that we could take to follow.
Right.
Yeah, we have a history.
Yeah, that's all I can say about it.
That cycle of the judges and cycle of the kings.
Yeah.
And in this process over and over and over and over, just again and again and again and again.
And we know that Jesus came out. Of course, all of this was put into play, I think, so that we can take and follow the scriptures and take and recognize that Jesus is truly the Son of God.
Okay. George?
I think sometimes we forget that Gentiles is a all-inclusive name, if you will, pretty much, for every nation that existed besides the Israelites. Even though the Bible does talk about Canaanites and other particular nations, but when it comes to how the word Gentile is used, it is intended, as far as I understand it, to mean everyone that wasn't an Israelite,
right,
a Jew.
Yeah, and that's really the question. Because when God called Abraham, what did he do with all the other nations? He gave them up? To walk in their own ways? Pretty much. Pretty much. So that's why I say there's certainly proof that Paul could be going back and saying, okay, first time God destroyed the entire creation to give people a clear remembrance. And, of course, what does Peter say in 2 Peter 3? This they willfully forget. In other words, that example should be something that no one ever forgets. But the fact is that when God called Abraham to fulfill his purposes, who did he work with from that time? Pretty much exclusively. Now, he would send a prophet off from time to time. We talked about this in our Wednesday night class. He would send a prophet off from time to time to go talk to Nineveh or go talk to Assyria and tell them, you need to straighten up. But did he send them a law and try to bring them back into submission to him like he did to Israel? So this is, I think, what Paul is describing here. We're going to get to the Jews in chapter 3. But here, I think we're dealing with everyone else, everyone but the Jews. Is dealt with here. But I don't think this is an exclusive single event. I think this happens over and over and over again, where God gives people up. And I think that is it possible America is getting close to that himself or itself? Yeah, go ahead.
So you earlier mentioned the word apostate, and I generally think of those as people who knew God in a law-given way or something like that. And the previous point that was just made is that because of creation, nobody has an excuse. There's God's all around you, and you should see God in the natural world that's around you. So because of that, you should be seeking out and following after the God that exists.
Right.
So sometimes I think we think of people as not being taught or maybe having excuse because they haven't specifically been given law. And that's, I guess, the point of the Gentiles. It's the Gentiles, whether they were specifically given law or it was patriarchal law passed down or however it occurred, they had a responsibility to seek out God and obey his will.
Right. Whatever it was. Yeah, and that's exactly right. That they knew God, and that's why I say, when they got off the ark, who knew God?
Everybody.
Everyone knew God. By the time of Abraham, did everyone know God anymore? No, a lot of them did not know God. Well, how did we get to that point? They knew God. They didn't glorify him as God. Is that what Cain did? Cain knew God, didn't glorify him as God, went out from the presence of God, and then what happens to his future generations? Well, they become the sons of men, that the sons of God are, or that they become the daughters of men, that the sons of God marry and brings the world into apostasy in chapter 6. So these people went away from God, but how quickly did they move God's people away from God?
Very quickly.
Very quickly. Very quickly. This chart on page 33 simply lays out that Noah was still alive when Abraham was born. So that's how quickly. Noah lived 350 years, and I noticed my chart doesn't have the extra one I put into the new one I have, so we'll have to deal with that later. But in mine, Noah was only dead 17 years when Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees when he was 75 years old. And the rest of them were all alive, with the exception of Peleg and Nahor. And of course, Terah died before his call too. Or no, I think he didn't die before his call, because he went with him to Haran. So all of these people pretty much still around. So if anybody wanted to go talk to Noah when Abraham was born and get firsthand testimony, was he still there? Yeah, he was still there. So they knew God, but in that 350-year period from the day Noah got off the ark until the call of Abraham, actually 290-year period, a lot of these things occurred that Paul is describing here. They knew God. They didn't glorify him as God. They became empty in their reasoning. They built the Tower of Babel. And what did God decide to do? Scatter them all over the creation. So we'll go ahead and stop here, because we're just about out of time. Actually, we're past out of time. But let's pick up in verse 21 next week on the bottom of page 32. And we'll continue on in this section. Thank you.